Join Big Daddy on the Big Daddy Liberty Show every Friday mornings at 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. on 101.9 High FM. The Big Daddy Liberty Show is the only show in South Africa that discusses current affairs, politics, and economic topics through the lens of liberty.
Molo Sanbonani, hello, how's it? Shalom. It is another Friday and another episode of the Big Daddy Liberty Show. I hope you have had a fantastic week as we are at the cusp of another Shabbat. Shabbat Shalom to you. And yeah, I hope you're having a wonderful morning. Guys, I have a jam-packed show for you. Remember, the show always begins by looking at the news that made, you know, the topical news that made us giggle or cry or angry in the week that was. And as usual, after the first break, I'm going to have a special guest. I did announce that I was going to have a one Mr. Zakhele Mthembu, someone who I, a young man, who I want you guys to hear a lot from. But however, he is, let's just say there's a slight change of plans. I've got an equally interesting guest for you after the break, Mr. Nicholas Babaya from the Institute of Race Relations. We're going to be talking about South African campuses at the moment. I'm sure you, ever since the Fees Must Fall days, have been paying some attention to what's happening on South African campuses across the country. The ructions, the violence, the protests, the destruction of public property. And I want to ask the question, you know, is there a culture of entitlement developing on our campuses, where students feel as though to get what they want, they need to be as destructive as possible? Have we lost the art of talking, engagement, being able to actually see eye to eye on issues, and more importantly, hearing rational arguments? So if someone says to you, I don't have something, accepting based on the evidence that may be true. So when I have that conversation after the break, look forward to that. But as always, I always begin with what made the news this week. But before I get there, guys, make sure you give me a shout on the show. I do appreciate your input into the show. You can do this by either finding me on social media. Just look for Big Daddy Liberty, either on Facebook or Twitter, and I will read your comments as they come up. Or, you know, as always, you can also find us on the studio number at 010-140-3020. Or send me a telegram at 061-895-1019. Or hey, if you're old school like your favorite fat boy Big Daddy, send me an SMS at 34519. Guys, welcome to it. Another episode of the Big Liberty Show, or rather the Big Daddy Liberty Show, excuse me. And there's a few things that have been on my mind this week. All of them, of course, topical. They've been in the news cycle, et cetera, et cetera. And maybe you've been thinking about them too. Let me begin here. It does seem like we're heading towards a situation where we're being told by politicians that they're in control, that they are, you know, everything is fine, dear South African, as they would say, we're in charge. Just trust us, says the wily politician. But when you then look at the actual evidence, when things happen, for instance, and I'm going to segue into coronavirus in this regard, things sort of happen that sort of burst the myth of politicians being in control. Let me be precise and specific. Perhaps for the last month or so, we've heard the health minister, Dr. Zweli Mkhize, wax lyrical about how prepared the South African government is, the Department of Health is, at what was then a looming possibility of the coronavirus coming down here. And, you know, he went to great lengths, including multiple press conferences, you know, lots of media attention. And, you know, some people actually felt quite comfortable. Like, okay, look, this man sounds like he knows what he's doing. We're prepared. We're very vigilant is the notion we got from the assurances of government. And then we find out that on the 1st of March already, a individual coming from Italy, a country we know already has quite a serious, essentially problem with the coronavirus. I mean, I'm talking, you know, state repression at levels of, you know, soldiers closing down neighborhoods, et cetera, et cetera. An individual on a flight from Italy just waltzed past the ORT, OR Tambo, security. Now, I don't know, I suppose, whether he was showing symptoms at the time or maybe he wasn't, but it stands to reason that at least ORT officials who would have been briefed presumably because of the crisis at the moment would have kind of, you know, given him a little bit of an extra attention at the point of entry. So, hey man, you've been to Italy. Have you been to any of these regions that have this, coronavirus? It doesn't seem like any of this happened. This man literally waltzed past security, found himself getting onto another plane to Durban, and you know, actually, thank God, you know, he himself self quarantined because I think he felt as though there was something wrong with himself. Now, what if that individual didn't have that self awareness? What if this was someone who maybe worked and works in a very public space and just said, hey, I just have a bit of flu, and coughed his way through spreading the virus? These are the sort of issues that I always rail against when I say government should never remove the individual sense of autonomy, the individual sense of vigilance on issues. We should never be lulled into thinking that we don't have to pay attention to issues. And that's why I think when I tweeted what I did, which was it's actually very laughable that the government sort of took upon itself this responsibility but then didn't actually mete it out to a large extent. You know, that people sort of took exception. Oh, but, you know, there's an incubation period. Yes, I get that. But surely there's some things that you can do that involve the public being more vigilant, that the state should have paid attention to. So that's one thing I'll be watching, I suppose, as the coronavirus now hits these shores and people start to panic. And I don't think we should panic. You know, I think what really should happen is the private sector should be roped in quite a lot to assist government in actually containing those who are sick, quarantining them, and actually putting a cap on this disease. I don't think we should be panicking, really, on this one. But let me move on, because I know coronavirus will be the hot news item for the foreseeable future, now that it's hit our shores. The other thing I paid attention to this week, which actually left me rather emotional, is the forensic findings that were released by the MEC of Education in this province in Gauteng, Mr. Panyaza Lesufi. This was into the matter, of course, of the death of Enoch Mpianzi, a young man, a 13-year-old from Parktown Boys High School. This young lad died in very tragic circumstances whilst the school had taken the boys out to a camp out at Nyati Bush Lodge. I think this is just outside Gauteng. And he died of a drowning, having essentially been, there was some water activity, but there seems to have been a lot of negligence from the teachers around this issue. And again, this forensic report points to that. I mean, it points to a situation where teachers were rather lax. And, you know, as the water activity was starting, the teachers themselves weren't even there, which begs the question. I mean, I thought back to my days when I was at, you know, in school and or high school or whatever, and we went on these camping trips. The teachers would be absolutely nuts about safety. You could not do anything as a learner that even had the whiff of being dangerous or even had the whiff of, you know, flouting any safety rules. But in this case, it seemed like the teachers almost, not that I wouldn't say they didn't care, because I don't have the evidence for that, but the evidence does point to them just having a lax approach to safety, even not even knowing that the boy was missing until 18 hours later when he was found. There's something very wrong in that sort of level of negligence. And I've been watching the headlines this morning that the parents will obviously be suing, and I think rightly so, because we need to inculcate a culture of accountability in this country. It isn't just for government. We shouldn't just be relegating that talk of accountability to government. We actually need to be inculcating it in all aspects of society, especially as a parent losing a child. So I'll be watching this one, and I'll bring you my views, especially as it develops. But after the break, as I said, I have a very special guest. He is looking rather ready to go at the moment, Mr. Nicholas Babaya from the Institute of Race Relations. I'll see you after these short messages.
Stay tuned for the Big Daddy Liberty Show on 101.9 High FM.
Guys, welcome back to the show. It is your favorite fat boy, Big Daddy Liberty. You're listening to the Big Daddy Liberty Show. Yay! Welcome back. As I said before the break, I have a special guest in studio, Mr. Nick Babaya, who's from the IRR, a special guest in the building. Nick, good morning.
Oh, good morning, Sihle. Good to be here once again.
Homie, good to have you on the show. As I sort of mentioned before the break, we're going to be looking at the culture that's sort of fested on South African campuses across the country. You yourself were a student not more than just a year ago, essentially. A
couple of months ago.
Less. yeah. And we've actually had you on the channel, albeit on the other show, the IRR show, because you are quite well-versed on all issues related to China.
Yes.
And just before the break, I was talking about the coronavirus, but that'll be another issue for another day. Nick, let me begin here. Ever since the fees must fall ructions, it does seem as though there has been a subculture developed, of having the politics type students, the students who are in student governance, you know, the SRC, being the major protagonist for disruptions on campuses. If you look at what's happening at WITS right now, that seems to be the case too. I don't know if you've been paying attention to it.
Yeah. I looked at some of the footage this morning, and I think one of the poignant things you have to really look out for whenever you see videos of these student protests is look how many students are dressed up in political party garb.
Yeah.
There's lots of ANC dukes, people wearing ANC shirts. I didn't see any EFF ones just from these WITS protests. But what I can tell you is that when I was at Rhodes University, amongst the Fees Must Fall and other protests that we had when I was there, there was a lot of people dressing up in the student political party, attire, apparel, and so on and so forth. And I actually asked this question on Facebook the one time during the midst of the Fees Must Fall protest in 2016. I said, you know, I see so many people wearing ANC attire. But, you know, and the Fees Must Fall issue was one that was very closely linked to the government. I said, okay, so who are you protesting against? Like, isn't that you guys that made it how it is, you know?
And it's a delicious irony to an extent of perhaps even the ordinary student asking themselves the question, am I being roped into this because the cause may be genuine? Or am I being roped into this because it helps propel certain political careers, upstart the political careers of students? And again, let me zoom in for a moment, because almost immediately after Fees Must Fall, a few choice select students who were propped up by the media as being these wonderful student leaders, look at how they led this mass movement, then got, you know, snapped up by various political parties and are today members of parliament. Does it feel like a bit of a slap in the face if you're a student who has sort of cajoled into this thing?
Yeah, well, I think it's unfortunately a bit of a bad result of how South African politics works. I mean, you know a lot about how it works with political parties in this country. If I had to say to you right now, I'm a first year student at university, I want to be an MP, what is your best advice to me? You would say probably join the local political party on your campus, be right in there the whole way going, and then if you get in the good books and you do well, you're going to eventually climb that ladder and you're going to eventually get on that political party list. So, I mean, this is the thing. I think people are using it to further their political goals. I've seen this, unfortunately, in quite a few parties. This is not exclusive to the ANC by any means.
Mm.
So, yeah, I think what you just said is true, certainly.
Which brings me then to perhaps this current one, because you asked the question, you know, or rather you raise the issue and then ask the question of where the EFF student command, their student iteration of their party, has been. I've seen some videos on social media where, you know, some of the EFF students have actually said, oh, we're not going to join this thing because it's an ANC thing. And, you know, if only they'd just come to us as EFF students, we would have dropped everything and shut down everything in order to join the ANC guys. But in that entire video, I never heard them once say, or actually would have done it based on the principle of the issue being raised. Because just for the listener's sake, the issue being raised here is on accommodation. You know, there is a shortage, as per the student's gripe, of student accommodation. And again, the university management, as far as we understand, and we've seen one of the management sort of stand up and is quite we've seen one of the managers of WITS University addressing the student and laying it out and explaining that, look, it's physically and financially impossible for the university to provide accommodation for every single student. And he then goes into some of the mitigating factors they've put in place to try and alleviate the actual crisis, including, you know, using a special fund. He mentions 14 million rand, to source 800 extra beds, which will sort of devoted specifically for students who are undergoing hardship. And he also mentions the fact that they've roped in the private sector, which I think is absolutely brilliant, to provide additional bedding. And he mentions about 11,000 extra beds, you know, which have been made available for them. So I do think if you go down that line, and we'll speak about this, Nick, I think that that's sort of the solution. But for students to then demand and almost shut down the entire university for the provision of 34,000 beds overnight, it just seemed a little unreasonable. And this is why I want to come back to you, Nick. Does it seem as though the student leadership that leads these protests, and by the way, this particular protest is not, it's at best about 100 people in terms of what I've seen.
As always.
It does seem as though the position of being as unreasonable as possible, and even bending the truth, actually just blatantly lying, does seem to be the MO of how some of this works in order to build your profile as a student leader.
Yeah, I think that's 100% true. I just want to start off with what you said there with the number of students. One thing I think the public should understand, and I think anybody who was at a university during these protests will know this for sure, is that whenever these big protests happen, it's actually a relatively small minority of students. Now, at Rhodes University, where I was, because Rhodes is a relatively small university, at some point it actually got down to probably under 100 students, only about 50 after about 3 weeks. So this is not by any means some kind of, here's the thing. The issues that they're raising are legitimate. Mm. Obviously, it's a tough situation when people don't have accommodation. That needs to be addressed. But the means by which they're addressing it, you have to ask if they have some kind of bad intentions here, just like you mentioned there. And I do think that furthering political goals is one of them. And that's why we see this sort of horde of like bitter angels, these guys who are like grinding it out until the very end. And I think there are other reasons why people do these kinds of things. They are entirely unreasonable, as you've mentioned. I mean, just because you deserve something or you believe you deserve something does not grant it immunity from scarcity.
Mm.
This is always the thing about economics, which I hope people would understand. Mm. But yeah, I think it's exactly the case. These people know that what they're demanding is unreasonable.
Mm.
But by just keeping that same line of speech, they can go on and use that as an excuse to actually go and disrupt lessons from students who may come from very disfortunate backgrounds, by the way, but actually just want to go learn. And let me add one more issue, which I think people don't consider sometimes. South Africa's got a lot of foreign students from other parts of Africa. My alma mater, Rhodes, has a particular relationship with Zimbabwean students. We have a large number of Zimbabwean students. This affects them very much as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, because when the times shift, when your exams have to be moved back because of all this nonsense that happens during the protest, it affects their visas. It affects how long they can be in the country. So, yeah, there are many, many negative effects that these people have, and they just don't think about that because they don't really think they're concerned about it in the first place.
Mm. And that's the problem to a large extent, is that it's being populist, if we're going to give it a word, being populist is really cool because, you know, you're always living in the moment. You're never worrying about the repercussions of what you're doing. There's no sense of leadership in that, ironically, in that regard. Because again, let me bring it back to these students who, you know, were propelled into the echelons of being some of the highest paid people as parliamentarians today. Very few of them, the kombucha came back. Very few of them actually look back and say, hey, what has actually been the outcome of what we did during the Fees Must Fall, times? I've never heard the Shaira Kalas, if I'm getting her name right, Vuyani Pambo, et cetera, et cetera. I've never heard them actually look back and introspect and say, you know, have we actually developed a culture on this campus which goes beyond the throwing the toys out the cots? You know, were we actually proper leadership in that regard of saying what we really want as students is to be able to open up avenues of dialogue with not only management, but the very people that those same managers are dependent on, the states being one and other stakeholders being the other. Do you feel as though they've opened up that culture, or have they actually opened the opposite culture, which is if you want something, you best believe you need to light some matches, don some face masks and, you know, trash a space in order to get it?
Well, I think that is part of the problem, is that's exactly what has happened. If ever there's some kind of issue which people can at least portray as being hugely important, then they know now that they can resort to violence, and the university administrations, by and large, I mean, it depends which university, but by and large, I think they have been way too soft. I mean, I don't want to sound harsh when I'm saying this, but quite frankly, this could have been avoided. Once you allow these people to think that by vandalizing property, you know, at UCT, you think about all the things that went on there. They were burning artworks. They burnt a bus. When you allow these people to get away with things which ordinarily would be heinous crimes, stuff you'd be put in jail with, it sends the message that whenever you're unhappy about something or whenever you want to accomplish some kind of goal, you can just go towards this thing. I think this is horrible for the student environment on South African campuses. You know, we actually do have some great universities here, but this is it's a small minority of students with political goals trying to ruin it for everyone. And this is not to say that we're not concerned about the issues which are being raised here. Of course we are. But you're going to get nothing done if this is the way that you approach it. And if you refuse to listen and refuse to have some dialogue and would rather resort to destroying property and burning things down like they did at UKZN. So yeah, and I think we have to really take into account that there may be some bad actors here. I hope the university management would also take that into account, that perhaps not everything these people are saying is the truth. It's just it's a little bit like the EFF during the State of the Nation address. Beforehand, they said, we are going to disrupt this address. During the address, they raised all these points of orders. But in that time, they pretended as if all their points of orders were legitimate, and then they got very angry at the speaker when she didn't address them, because she kind of knew that they were there just to cause a fuss, just to filibuster a little bit. I think this is the same thing.
Let me zoom in for a moment, just before, we've got sort of like 6 minutes before the first break, and then we'll have you on again for the last 10 minutes as we look to some of the interventions I think should go into place. But let's look at this element of the failure perhaps of not only university management, but the state to enforce the rule of law. Because the rule of law is actually quite important in this regard. It helps protect life, liberty, and actual property rights, not only for the university, but for those other students, for example, you mentioned. I mean, those students who come here from foreign countries and, you know, do so within very confined parameters of visa regulations and the like, The issue of the rule of law is super important, and I think we must hash it out. When Fees Must Fall happened, and the students became emboldened to be able to do things like, burn whole buildings, burn buses, for example, at UCT. And the one case at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, was it actually Durban University of Technology, was a young man named Kaya Tsegeshe, who was apprehended by the police for burning a police vehicle, for actually setting it alight. And, you know, he was one of the only people I can actually really think of from that period who was not only arrested, prosecuted, but also convicted. He was, you know, sort of handed down an 8-year sentence, which he subsequently appealed and the like. But here's where I'm going with this. When this young man was actually caught and he was facing the consequences of his behavior, in this case, his criminal behavior, then immediately, you know, all your social media who's who came to his cause and said, oh, how unfair that we're treating a criminal like a criminal. Like, how dare we do this? This criminal was fighting for the rights of students. Who are we to say that students who are angry about their inability to afford fees shouldn't burn police cars? Of course they should, as we were told by the sort of, the popular types on social media. And they literally rallied behind the student, including, you know, providing legal counsel. Some very famous lawyers, Themba Ngugai Thobi is one, who was very vocal and lent, I think, even legal assistance trying to get this young man out. Under the narrative, Nick, that he is a victim of a system which is enforcing the law unfairly. It does seem as though that we are allergic in this country, at least the sort of chattering classes, we're allergic to actual consequences and the idea that the law is actually here to protect everybody. Do you want to chip in on this?
Yeah. You know, I think that's true. This is an interesting topic because of South Africa's history. There are obviously times throughout the world and in various places where there are laws that are unjust. And you highlight the injustice of those laws by breaking it. Okay, we saw that loads of times during the apartheid phase. And I think people see themselves as that kind of thing. But then we actually need to ask the question, okay, is the law against burning down a police vehicle a good law? Yes, I would say that's a fairly good law. I think it's bad, generally speaking, to burn things down. I don't know about you, but I'm tend to be against burning stuff down that isn't yours. Okay, does burning down the police vehicle in any way enhance the struggle for free education or a more affordable education? Of course not. Okay, how is that constructive in any manner whatsoever? So, no, I think these people do these hugely radical acts and then try to justify it by using their cause. But the fact is that the one is just has absolutely no link to the other. Mm. What was her name? Rosa Parks was famous because she sat on the bus in violation of the law that said you can't sit in this place in the bus. There was a relation between the act of defiance and the law which was unjust. In this case, the law is not unjust, and the act of defiance is for a cause that has nothing to do with against the law. So, look, there's really no logic here. But I think I'm almost arguing in futility here because there doesn't have to be logic for these people. They don't really – I think a lot of it is just like the heat of the moment. It's just the mob mentality that makes you do these kind of things. Now, think about – I'll bring up another example. I remember when I was at university, there were a lot of windows that got broken. So people were throwing a lot of things, and a lot of windows on various university buildings were broken. Now, consider yourself if you're walking down the streets of Johannesburg, and you picked up a rock and you threw it at a window of some building, and that window broke, and police tried to arrest you. Of course they would, because you've just broken somebody else's property. But for some reason, the entire situation changes, especially how the public views it, when it's a mob of people, especially students who try to do this, and they think that the cause is right, even though the cause has got nothing to do with the means that they're doing. So, yeah, we need to be very, very consistent here, and you need to, if you're going to take this angle, you have to be careful that what you're doing has got some kind of relationship to the end goal, but also that the law that you're breaking is actually a bad law. Mm. So, no, I think in reality that's not the case in 21st century South Africa.
All right. We did say that, it's not that we're railing against the issues they're raising. I think they are serious issues. And after this break, we're going to look at some of these issues and perhaps what some of the solutions can be to addressing them. Guys, I'm with Nick Babaya from the Institute of Race Relations.
You are listening to the Big Daddy Liberty Show.
Guys, welcome back to the Big Daddy Liberty Show. I'm your favorite fat boy, Big Daddy Liberty. Remember, you can get involved in this conversation, especially as we're in the last 8 minutes of our interview with Mr. Nick Babaya. We're talking all things university and student related. And I asked the question, is there an entitlement culture that's developing, a destructive one at that? You can get involved in that conversation. Maybe you are a parent who has kids at university and you've been affected by some of these protests. What has it meant for you on a personal level? Guys, holler at your big boy. Send me a telegram at 061-895-1019 or an SMS at 34519. Remember, you can also find me online by sending me any of your comments to the at Big Daddy Liberty social media feed, whether that's on Facebook or Twitter. I'll read your comments and we'll put it to the guest in studio. The guest, remember, is Mr. Nick Babaya from the IRR. And before the break, Nick, I did mention that, I want us to look at, as we said, the issues that the students are raising are actually quite serious. And, they're legit. Student housing, big issue. We totally get it. The inability to afford fees. And let me just add a little caveat here. I don't think everybody should be going to university, firstly. I think this economy needs skills which are much more practical and everyday, such as, your artisanal type skills. And let's include that in the discussion of how we could fund quite easily, or better rather, young people getting into these areas. So let's begin on the issue of housing. Nick, a lefty might come into this conversation. I'm going to play the lefty for a moment as just, a bit of a devil's advocate and say, yes, Nick, of course you liberals are going to say that we need the private sector. But no, the private sector has a record of exploiting people. What I want is the state to print money and just dole it out to the universities so that all students can be given a roof over their head, a fantastic one at that. Nick, how am I wrong, firstly, and what solutions would you propose?
Okay, well, printing money is just about the worst thing anyone could ever do, because then that leads to hyperinflation. Then we won't even have to worry about student accommodation, because we start to worry about how do we have food on our table. So there's problem number one. But basically a more fundamental problem thereof is the fact that the South African government is not exactly overflowing with money right now. We spend a lot of money badly. We're in terrible debt. Our state-owned enterprises have also got a lot of debt, which people don't realize. So basically, to cut a long story short, we're not in a position to spend a whole bunch more money right now. Okay, so how would getting the private sector involved help us out? Well, there are many places in the world in which private student accommodation is a real business. And if you bring a lot of competition into the market, the more competition you have will naturally bring the price down. Now, it's not quite as simple as that, because South Africa is not the greatest business environment in the world, and we have a lot of laws which make life a bit difficult. Mm. But if you think about it, even if we just had an abundance of accommodation, let's forget about price for a moment, but if we had enough so that everybody, there was at least a bed for everyone, immediately that would start to bring, take the pressure off the residences which are on the university campus or owned by the university in the first place. You could, if you wanted to, for now, you could bring some subsidies. Well, the government does already subsidize public universities. That's why university accommodation is the cheapest. But at least what I'm saying is that you would have demand meeting the supply. And that would be just a fantastic beginning. And if you allowed the private sector to come into that and provide accommodation as a business, you would naturally see prices falling, because that's one of the economic effects of having more supply. So, you know, at the end of the day, the market always wins with these things. You really can't argue against it. You can try to be a command economy like North Korea, but I see no reason that we go down that path. So I think that's a good way to start, at least for accommodation, at least just try to meet the demand.
Mm. Now, someone who listens to that might then say, but hang on, like, do you really want to bring in the private sector? I mean, surely...
Yes, I
you
do.
Know, immediate answer there. you know, what sort of initiatives can we expect then? You know, should we be encouraging universities to actually look at maybe investors and say, guys, you know, there's a lot of dilapidated buildings around, in and around the university, especially here in Johannesburg is a good example. Mm. Fix this up. We'll provide an incentive insofar as we'll give you students who are financially stable, those who maybe have bursaries and the like, so you're guaranteed to receive your rent from them. Would that be a better way of approaching this issue in the long term?
Yeah, I think constructive things like that are generally a very constructive way to go forward with that. For example, a university, I think this would be a great idea if a lot of universities did this. I don't quite know what the situation is, but at Rhodes University, if you got at least two distinctions, or at least half your subjects were distinctions, you immediately got a certain percentage off your fees. So I think a great thing, for example, would be to create incentives from students who are perhaps from a relatively poorer backgrounds, that if they did extremely well in their studies, the university would assist them in that regard. And you could actually have partnerships between the university, which is a public entity, and private residences for things like this. Now, from the perspective of a person who owns a private residence, how great would it be to just to have this infinite demand for your product, because you would have a partnership with the university and you would be in proximity to the university. So I think there's lots of things which can be explored to this. Now, as you mentioned, playing the devil's advocate in the first scenario here, there are some people who think that the private sector is inherently evil and will exploit people. I'm not really, you know, people always use this kind of rhetoric, but the fact of the matter is that when you don't have demand meeting, when you don't have supply meeting demand, the result is that you get a situation at Wits like people sleeping in the library. Is that not exploiting people? You know, so I think a lot of this is just purely ideological, and people hate to think that the private sector can do something good for society. But if you just open your mind really to anything, let's not be ideological here. Stuff like that could be, I think, very constructive in this country. Unfortunately, and I'm sure we'll talk about it just now, the South African government has a streak that is very anti-private sector. And I think that's part of the reason why we are a little bit in the situation as we are.
Mm. Maybe in our last 2 minutes, let's look at the issue of funding very briefly. You know, there's this massive demand that we should be getting the state involved on the issue of funding. You know, the state should provide massive subsidies to universities, big payouts to students. But there's an economic problem in this one, and America has shown us how it can be a problem, hasn't it?
Yeah, so what's happened in America really is that many, many students in America have to take out loans in order to pay their fees. To give you an idea, student fees in America are extraordinarily expensive. They're like 15 to 20 times, at least anecdotally, that's what I've seen. And so you get places like Harvard University, which is the top in the world, in which a huge majority of students are on some kind of financial aid. Now, they're able to do that because they get lots of endowments. But the problem is that if you increase demand so much, then the prices will just go up and up and up. You know, these things always come with some kind of trade-off. So you have to keep that in mind. And what I would hope that we could do is actually make it much easier for people to start private institutions of higher learning, as some people like Solidarity have been doing. But the government seems very anti this. They're very against this, and I'm not sure why. I think it's a purely ideological thing, and it's very unfortunate.
Ladies and gentlemen, that is Mr. Nicholas Babaya from the Institute of Race Relations, a writer and analyst over there. Remember, you can find all his writing and analysis on the Daily Friend website. That's www.dailyfriend.co.za. After the break, I look at some of the issues that I think you should be paying attention to and what's happening on social media.
This is the Big Daddy Liberty Show.
Hello guys, welcome back to the Big Daddy Liberty Show. My name is Big Daddy Liberty. I'm your favorite fat boy and welcome to it. We're in the last sort of 8 minutes of the show, and as what we usually do at this time, we go through social media and maybe look at some of the news items that we should be expecting going into the weekend and into next week. Guys, I began just before the major interview with Mr. Nick Babaya, going through some of the stuff that has made the news, the one thing I forgot was the reactions that we've seen in Cape Town with the group of refugees who had for a very long time, about 5 months already, essentially protested just outside a Methodist church in the city center. And that's, for those who are aware of, you know, Cape Town, it's just next to the Green Market Square where a lot of the informal trading happens. And the issues they had were that they wanted the United Nations to basically, ship them to first world countries because they argued they're being sort of persecuted in their communities in Cape Town by xenophobia. Now, this has obviously been proven to not necessarily be 100% true, because I know the city of Cape Town and other law enforcement agencies looked into these claims, and it was part of the court process that then happened where the city and a few other stakeholders, you know, went to the courts and said, look, we need to, this is an untenable situation in terms of, the health of the individuals there, of living on the street corner, for example, in these very large groups and very densely packed. And, you know, the city eventually, you know, got a court order basically saying they may move these individuals. And for the past week, it's been this sort of cat and mouse of, you know, removing them from them. By the way, the court order said nothing about those who were in the church. I think they were quite fine, and, you know, they're still receiving, there's about 100 people or so in the church, and they're quite fine. The issue was the hundreds of individuals who were then outside, camping outside, you know, setting up tents and the like. The city, under J.P. Smith, who's their MACO member for safety and security, actually did quite a good job of basically saying, guys, you're flouting the law and you're making it, you know, you're creating a very dangerous situation, really, not only for yourselves, but also for the children you have, you know, living on the streets when every single one of them come from actual homes. They've left actual homes. These are not necessarily, you know, indigent homeless people. These are people who come from homes and just argue that they can't stay in them. You know, you need to go back. I mean, the court has rather settled this. And if anything, you need to engage the UN on more sort of, perhaps, I don't know what word to use here, but on a more formal basis, if this is the gripe you necessarily have. And it's been spectacular to see the Department of Home Affairs, who are actually responsible for this issue by and large, not lifting a finger to assist. So I think this is one we need to watch, because it'll set a precedent perhaps across the country where foreign nationals who have moved to South Africa, sought asylum here, maybe even got it, then say, hey, we demand a local government to basically, or even the U.S., or rather, we demand the UN to fly us to first world countries, and if that doesn't happen, we'll essentially make life for the rest of those who live in this country a misery and break the law. I think there's something that needs to be said, and this one needs to be watched, because it really does have, you know, implications for the concept of the rule of law and maintaining law and order. That's one which I really wanted to watch. On social media, this also did break, and there was actually very tragic scenes in some cases of these people being moved. Don't get me wrong, I do share some sympathy for what they're going through, but at the same time, I do feel as though there are elements within that group who are maybe stoking up a lot of this disruption and using false pretenses, because I've never heard anywhere in the world where if you're in a stable country, which South Africa by and large, I mean, given some of our issues, but by and large, it is a stable country for an asylum seeker to flee to, then demanding that that country or the UN in that country should fly them to another, yet another, stable country. I don't think that's a precedent that's been set anywhere in the world. And I think this is something we need to watch. Guys, another big one that we need to pay attention to. If you follow me on my social media feed, remember that's at Big Daddy Liberty on Twitter, or look for Big Daddy Liberty or the Big Daddy Liberty Show on Facebook. You'll see that I've been running a bit of a cheeky campaign at the moment, railing against some of the bad ideas that are beginning to affect the daily lived and life, quality of life rather, of South Africans. And one of those ideas is the slow creep we seem to be moving into of mainstreaming socialism. Now, any one of you who are listening to me know that, you know, historically we've defeated, back in the sort of Cold War era, socialism. And, but it is making a comeback. And a lot of people sort of dispute this when I say it on social media. Oh, how can you say that the ANC is not socialist? The EFF is not socialist. But actually they are. And just because you're not seeing people in brown shirts marching and frog marching people in the streets and shooting dissidents doesn't mean that the ideas themselves aren't being repackaged and being shoved down the throats of South Africans in nefarious ways. Because socialism, at the end of the day, is the idea that the state and politicians control everything in society, and you, the individual, have very limited in the way of freedoms and choice making. Everything goes through the state. And if you look at the ideas that the ANC have been touting, expropriation without compensation, the national health insurance, all of these things are state centric. Bailing out continuously state owned enterprises, all of these things are state centric. So we're seeing these ideas come back, and I'm beginning to rail against them. And I'm of the view that socialism is absolute trash. It's absolute, it's a cancer to an extent, because it slowly kills a society. So watch out for that on my social media. I'm taking this campaign across the country as I remind South Africans that socialism is cancer. So watch out for that. Remember to follow me on all my social media, guys. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Big Daddy Liberty Show. I will see you guys next Friday, and Shabbat Shalom.